You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the November 2025 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part A. Here's the continuation of Realm of the Coin by Zoe Bernard with photos by Michelle Grosskopf. There is a survivor bias in crypto, where the winners are the ones telling the story, says Andy Folio, a videographer who spends some 18 hours a day leverage trading cryptocurrencies. Same with the entertainment industry. The winners are the ones on stage telling you to chase your dreams. The gamblers on Twitter are like, don't stop clicking. Kids these days feel the only way to make it is through gambling. In November, I was drawn to the irresistible lure myself during a visit to my hairdresser. Over a head of highlights, he told me in great detail about all the coins he'd been buying. He had parked some $200,000 in a cryptocurrency that everyone was talking about at the time, as well as tens of thousands more in a popular meme coin. He had done all this on the advice of one of his clients, a guy who, according to my hairdresser, had made identical trades. This guy, my hairdresser said, wielding a stack of foil, put in millions. Up until this point, I wasn't the kind of person who would take random investment advice from my hairdresser, talented though he may be in the art of balayage. But since the pandemic, I'd had a creeping sense that the rules no longer applied. The system was rigged and ready to break. Among my friends, it was a running joke. Might as well enjoy ourselves before we're all living in bunkers. That night, I went home and put $7,000, a not insubstantial sum to a freelance journalist, on the cryptocurrency my hairdresser recommended. In just under a month, I nearly doubled my money. The next month, I downloaded a wallet and learned how to track meme coins on Dex Screener. I was now closely monitoring a private group chat that Taub invited me to on X called It's Time to Nut. I began taking investment advice from an amphibian avatar named Fwog Bonner. But I found that trading meme coins wasn't something I could do casually. I'd step away from my laptop for a few moments to take a phone call or run an errand, and find that the $100 or so dollars I'd put on a coin had evaporated. After shaving a few thousand off my initial winnings, I lost my appetite and gave up. I had only tasted a fraction of the pain meme coin losses can incur. The $30,000 that Zara, the crypto trader who lives on the cannabis farm, put into meme coins directly out of her savings grew at its peak to $1.7 million. Then the market nuked, and I kept trading down, she says. I was like, let me just average out here. And then I was left with nothing, with dust. While I only traded meme coins a few short weeks, it permanently scrambled the way I thought about finance and money. For one, it readjusted my appetite for risk. Cryptocurrencies now felt slow, the stock market glacial. Yet the most unexpected development was this. My understanding of money was now completely abstracted. It was numbers on a screen that went up and down. An entire generation has come to think about money this way. To young people, money has always been fake numbers on the internet, a cryptocurrency business founder tells me. And because these numbers are tied to an online economy made up of trivial jokes and crude cartoons, losing it can feel just as surreal as winning. This was true for Vanessa Sierra, a former Love Island Australia contestant, who, after losing $100,000 in a few short days, was left only momentarily speechless. Had it happened with real money, it would have affected me a lot more, she says. If it was in my bank account, I would be crying for days. Everything is a market in some sense, says Austin Adams, the founder of an on-chain markets company called Whetstone Research. If you're not thinking about it as a market, someone else is thinking about it for you. You post on Facebook and Instagram and say, this isn't a market. But it is. There's a market being run in the background on an ad exchange that's demanding your attention. We have to admit this is a market and that someone else is extracting that value through something else. It used to be that the value of an investment was tied to its perceived usefulness or performance. But all this changed with the arrival of meme stocks. These stocks typically represented companies that were not particularly useful or promising, but they were valuable for one important reason. People on the internet talked about them a lot. Attention has always been valuable, but difficult to price. A blue check on Instagram promises credibility. A large follower count or a viral moment can open a world of opportunity. Attract as many eyeballs as you like, but there was never any way to cash in on the gaze itself. So it's just the next phase, says Bark, a crypto influencer who, according to a woman who knows him, is running what amounts to a full-blown cult on X. Anything he tells his audience to do, they'll do, she says. You make people money, they'll worship you. Having clout and followers and blue check marks had value, but there was no way you could put a dollar on it, Bart continues. Now we're putting a dollar on it. This may be why people who spend most of their time making products that live on the internet are drawn to the world of crypto, where even micro-influencers can create tokens tied to their online popularity. One such influencer is a guy called Fluffy, who, when I met him at Meme House LA, gave the impression of an ebullient, larger-than-life Nintendo Mario, dressed in red and white striped overalls and a red cap. Fluffy has his own meme coin, which he says is so stressful because my face is on it. If this coin goes bad, it ruins my whole persona in Web3. When Fluffy starred in a commercial for a crypto company called Bullpen earlier this year, his token's total value increased from $28,000 to $40,000 because, as he puts it, people saw me as the commercial. They saw that I was actually putting in work, trying to entertain the world, which correlated to the token getting bought, and that makes me feel good. Next, photos, tokens of appreciation. The trading room at Meme House, LA. And crypto influencer Fluffy, who has his own meme coin, tending to household chores. There is an annoying problem with the nature of attention, however. It tends to alight on the collective imagination with seemingly capricious randomness. But what if you could control where attention was headed next? This, in the view of Amy Street, a former kindergarten teacher who became a crypto influencer after flipping two NFTs for a combined $18,000, is the current trajectory. I'm not in control of whether or not Elon Musk uses the phrase Doge over and over again, or if Labubus are cool in 2 months, she says. But I do control if I'm going to get a tattoo of an eggplant on my stomach. And if there is money on the line, people are going to do some crazy stuff. Bull runs create hunger for money, and people do crazy things and put up a lot of money. That comment about the eggplant tattoo is something Street picked up from a crypto company she's working with called Dare Market, which has yet to launch. The idea is in the name, a market of dares where people pay bounties that others cash in on by recording themselves performing crowdsourced challenges. These dares, according to the company's founder, Isla Rose Perfito, a bubbly blonde 29-year-old living in New York, could include things like breaking into a Scientology center, moving into a McDonald's for 24 hours, and getting people to streak at the Super Bowl. The goal, says Perfito, is to break the internet. It's the Black Mirror / Jackass coded, but still super relatable. It'll give you the feeling that you can change the world and the adrenaline rush of driving a fast car. I tell her it all sounds a bit like Squid Game, the TV show about poor people who play deadly children's games in order to win a prize fronted by wealthy spectators. It is, yeah, she says brightly. It's very similar. Stephanie Stancheva, a professor of economics at Harvard University, has documented an explosive uptick in the U.S. in zero-sum thinking, what she describes as a mindset that if you or a group of people wins, it must mean that someone else loses. This belief has grown on a drastic scale, especially among young people who experience less upward mobility than previous generations. Today, many people think that their jobs are much worse than their parents, and that good jobs are just not attainable to them, which is driving this idea that their job will not be sufficient to give them an income, she says. I'm just trying to break out of the matrix, man, Vera, a meme coin trader at Meme House LA, tells me. I don't want a 9-to-5 job for the rest of my life. I see so much money in this market being thrown around every day. Why not learn how to reach in and grab some? During the 5 hours that I visited the Meme House LA, the meme coin traders, including Vera, rarely left their desk. There they sat for hours, clicking and clicking away. Sometimes I check in on their live streams, where I watch them performing on-camera challenges, partying on a yacht, and, of course, trading meme coins, chasing the jackpot. Now here's the November 2025 Vanity Fair cover story, Brat's Next Act. Just married, pivoting to film in magnificent fashion, after a seemingly endless summer of Brat, Charlie XCX talks to Anna Peel about her new season of stardom. Assisted by sittings editor Max Ortega. Opening photo of Charlie XCX by director Greg Araki, or appearing with in Los Angeles with director Greg Araki, wearing a dress by Schiaparelli. Charlie XCX is emoting more than seems possible for someone whose eyes, in public at least, are nearly always conveying vacant disdain or covered by sunglasses. I arrived at her Hollywood Hills home as requested before 8 a.m., an inconceivable meeting time for a person who loves to go out so much that she named one song for what she expects to hear when she's partying, club classics, and another for the number of days a year she partakes in such activities, 365. Throughout the conversation in her poolside courtyard, Charlie rests on the lounge chair in every possible permutation of repose, from elbows on knees to partial recline to supine, and then supine the other way, another Charlie banger, 360. Charlie is freshly showered, twisting her damp waves until a tumbleweed of hair falls to the ground and rolls across the patio. She is freckled. Who knew Charlie XCX had freckles? And makeup-free. She is also bra-free, though we have seen that before. Her ubiquitous Balenciaga and Mueller bags are elsewhere. She is wearing Bottega Veneta flats and a stomach-covering vintage T-shirt featuring three buxom women drawn by fetish artist Eric Stanton, as well as jeans by Guess, which are impossible to look at without triggering the lyrics of Charlie's song of the same name featuring Billie Eilish. George Daniel, drummer for the 1975 and her husband of 2 weeks, keeps walking by with a beatific smile. Every time he does, Charlie exclaims his name in excitement, as if she's run into him somewhere she wasn't expecting to, rather than in their kitchen. "This is George," she tells me delightedly, introducing us as he heads out for a hike with their rescue mutt, Nico, named for the singer. "Are you going to Runyon?" Charlie asks about the hiking destination that is as well trafficked in Los Angeles as the Air One smoothie line. "No, George and Nico are headed to Bronson Caves." "Oh, cute," Charlie says. Everything to do with Daniel is cute. Soon they'll be on a second wedding cum honeymoon in Italy. "It will be lovely," Charlie says, "just eating mountains of pasta and drinking spritzes." George and Charlie's kitchen is open to the patio and features a truly enormous dining room table with bench seating. Taylor Marie Prendergast, moody black and white art, hangs on every wall, and a large easel holds a drawing of a tree that Charlie sketched. The whole tableau is, right now, being blasted by morning sun from massive east-facing windows. I ask about the life events that made the purchase of this opulent home possible, and Charlie openly wonders whether she can trust me enough to answer my question. Early hits like Boom Clap and I Love It were huge, but Charlie wasn't particularly. As she told Kareem Rama on his interview series Subway Takes last year before Brat came out, "Some artists have a song, but a song isn't enough." Charlie says many friends have asked her, "You're in your 30s now. Do you feel like you're more equipped to handle this? What do you think would have happened if this had happened when you were 18? But Charlie says it kind of did happen. She was almost a plus one to the world-famous songs she had created, which allowed her to travel and perform internationally and to engage with a kind of half version of what was to come. She was featured in publications like The Guardian and Rolling Stone, but the framing tended to focus on Charlie's permanent status in the waiting room of A-listhood, where she was left to toil in niche brilliance. "I dipped my toe in, but I wasn't fully in," she says. "I think having that experience probably equipped me well for this happening." So now that Brat is over, Charlie stops me as I put that to her. "I don't really get to decide when it's over or not," she says. "I think that's up to the world. It will eventually exist as a relic. I don't think people will forget it," she says. "On the other hand, it's not effing new wave. The end will be interesting," Charlie says, "because then I have to look at myself in a different way and be stripped of the thing that everyone identified me with." Whatever this post-Brat version of Charlie XCX is, she says, "I won't be staring into the abyss wondering what I'm going to do." At least part of what she's going to do is turn into a movie star. Charlie has 7 films coming out soon, including 3 that debuted at the Toronto or Venice film festivals in September. There's Erupta, an indie film that emerged from her friendship with playwright Jeremy O. Harris, and an unplanned meeting with director Pete Oz at Clandestino. Charlie also features in the fantasy 100 Nights of Hero, starring Emma Corrin, and the echo satire Sacrifice with Chris Evans and Anya Taylor-Joy. Charlie will have a lead role in The Moment, distributed by A24, a revisionist history focused on the aftermath of Brat's release, in which she stars with Alexander Skarsgård. She is also writing songs for 2 major projects, including the Anne Hathaway-led pop idol epic Mother Mary. But this is just the next moment. "I not only know that this won't last forever," Charlie says, "I'm also really interested in the fact that it doesn't." When I ask how much more famous she feels when she's in the wild now, Charlie drops into the face she assumes out there. The chin lowers, the eyes die in a way that is profoundly withering. Hedonistic with the gravel drawl and dead eyes, mean girls. She uses her index fingers to pull her temple skin into a vulpine angle she normally achieves with tight hidden braids. Her hair seems to get bigger. "Oh my God," I say, "that's Charlie." "There it is," she says, smiling again. "I'm always thinking about how I look and what I would change about my face," Charlie says, citing her favorite plastic surgery website, Real Self, for giving her the resources to know that she can't achieve a permanent version of the braid eye tilt with sugar threads. At some point, she says, she probably will get a mid-facelift. "I'm effing thinking about all the shit that I could do and pull and stretch and morph on my face all the time," Charlie says. "I have to just remind myself that maybe I can't get too sucked into that." She recently stopped getting Botox. "I miss it," she says mournfully. Her acting roles were what prompted the break from paralytic injectables. "I did a couple of audition tapes where I had Botox, and my eyebrows were doing that crazy thing when they kind of lift." She drags up the outer edges to demonstrate the look, which evokes Jack Nicholson's distinctive brows. "They look great on him," Charlie says. The XCX persona, embodied by the face, is also a real facet of Charlie's life and personality that was first amplified long ago. "I see some analogy with someone like Dolly Parton, who is a performer, and you're using that character. It is part of you. But there's a little bit of that role-playing going on," says Charlie's longtime collaborator, A.G. Cook. "At the same time, it's a very real version of Charlie that is becoming more known," Cook says. Next photo, party girl. As a teen, Charlie's parents took her to illegal raves to perform. Here she wears a dress by Balenciaga, 54th Couture, and a necklace by Van Cleef & Arpels. Charlie grew up as a multiracial, frizzy-haired little girl in Essex, near London. She's the only child of a white British entrepreneur and a Gujarati Indian flight attendant and nurse who came to the UK after her family was expelled from Uganda by the dictator Idi Amin. Charlie's parents supported her interest in the arts by taking the teenager to perform at illegal raves. She signed a deal with Asylum Atlantic Records in 2009, half her life ago. Of Atlantic, Charlie says, it used to be quite a turbulent relationship, and now it's just really not. She partially attributes the shift at the label to the fact that they used to really not like that I was kind of a bitch, and now I guess they know it can sell. Charlie is pleased that Atlantic does not demand she collaborate creatively. I'm not open to feedback, she says. Like, that's not what your job is. We can all pretend that it is, but it's not. I ask if she ever does just nod along and pretend their input is valuable, simply to get through the meeting. I don't go to the meeting, she says. Lest this make her seem rude, Charlie clarifies, I don't want to make it sound like the label are idiots. They're definitely not. But I think it's like everybody has their strengths, right? The label's role? They're a bank, she says. They advance Charlie money to go off, do her thing with people she actually does want to collaborate creatively with, come back, tell them what and when the rollout is, and rent the tractor loader so she and Eilish can ride through a jillion bras and panties in the guest music video. At this point, Charlie says, they want to just do that. They want to support the vision. The vision is lucrative, after all. We're in a good place, and I wouldn't swap it for anything, Charlie says, adding, the devil you know. I don't even think my driving factor has been, I want to be the biggest pop star ever in the world, or anything like that, Charlie says of her career goals. I always just wanted to make music on my own terms and have as many people listen to it as possible, which sounds really simple. But I think I've really struggled over the years because I've never felt like I fit in. Am I supposed to be this underground left artist, or am I supposed to try and be this commercial package? And I think before Brat, I just gave up on fighting with myself on that. I really said, okay, I'm going to make this record in this specific way, and I'm actually fine with the consequences of that. If it means no one hears it, if it means I get dropped by my label. As we know, the consequence was Charlie becoming one of the biggest pop stars in the world. In April 2024, less than 2 months before the release of Brat, Charlie and Troye Sivan announced they were headlining the Sweat Tour, a six-week North American arena run. Last spring, Sivan was the bigger artist, promoting his album Something to Give Each Other. The single Rush was, in Sivan's words, popping off. Charlie told Sivan she was anxious she would negatively impact the tour. I was worried that people would be like, oh no, who's this girl preventing us from hearing Rush, she says. And then obviously, you know, things kind of changed for me. On June 7th, Brat debuted. On June 27th, Charlie made a surprise appearance at Sivan's solo London show. He had the idea that the stage should go black, then turn the sickly color of the album cover, then Charlie would appear in silhouette. The sound that came out of the crowd when she appeared, with the wind in her hair and the Brat green background behind her, it was a completely overwhelming response, Sivan says. I get chills thinking about it now. He was thrilled as a friend, but also as a fan. I am so happy to be a part of the community of gays that have been following her for so long, Sivan says. Charlie reciprocates the devotion. She says she feels super indebted to her queer fans. She's been our queen for a really long time, says Sivan. I feel very honored to get to represent the gays that have died for her forever. Charlie is a completist when it comes to seeking out people's opinions about herself, from the gays that die for her to journalists. She wants to know how people discuss her on social media, how critics perceive her, what the newer listeners make of all of this. It's fascinating to see how people ingest your personality and spit it back out. What people cling on to, what people miss, Charlie says. I'm always interested in, like, what does the casual viewer think? And they probably think I'm a girl who parties and does drugs and is a little bit bitchy. So is 365 a commentary on people's perception of her? No. I am saying I'm a 365 party girl, Charlie says. 365 is a song about going to a party. Feeling yourself. Feeling really hot. But essentially, getting really crazy because you're running away from something. Then, as the song progresses, everything gets a little wilder and more effed up sonically as the person is getting more wild and effed up. And by the end of it, it's kind of sad. In the photo, Mr. and Mrs. Bratt. In July, Charlie wed George Daniel in a civil ceremony at London's Hackney Town Hall. And next photo, new muse, Charlie with photographer Aidan Zamiri, who in 2024 directed her music video for 360. The 365 party girl is definitely not effed up right now, just effing exhausted. A few days ago, Charlie celebrated turning 33 by the same pool we're sitting beside. It was a sedate affair that also feted her best friend and interior designer Georgia May Somery, who had a birthday around the same time. Charlie needed a break from all the more standard partying she's done in the past year or so, including her 32nd birthday, attended by Eilish, Taylor Joy, Glenn Powell, Lorde, Addison Rae, and Rosalia, who brought a bouquet of Parliament cigarettes for the honoree. It was perfect, Charlie says. It was just one of those classically L.A. nights where word of mouth spreads and then people just come. I think a lot of people felt that it was performative or something, but I think maybe they were just mad they weren't there, Charlie smirks. What can I say? When all my friends are drunk, they like posing for photos. If enough people say that it is true on the internet, it becomes the truth, Charlie says, of all the misperceptions about her. I ask why she doesn't correct the record. You can't, she says. That just makes it bigger. Fact-checking is dead, Charlie tells me, which will come as a surprise to Vanity Fair's research department. She says doing this cover story and being vulnerable and open while imagining what, say, the Daily Mail will aggregate from it is scary, even though the theoretical concept of how information is decontextualized fascinates her. I have a big mouth and I say shit, and sometimes it gets me in trouble, Charlie says. You seem lovely, but were you trying to get me on your side so I would reveal more? I don't know. Charlie appeared on the podcast Les Culturistas 2 days before Bratt debuted. During the interview, she wavered about whether she would reveal who the album's songs were about. My thing is, people are going to guess, she told host Bowen Yang and Matt Rogers, before declining to name the inspiration for Girl So Confusing about a complicated relationship with another female musician who has similar hair to Charlie's. I think you probably both have an accurate guess, Charlie said. It's probably that person. It was Lorde, who likely would have remained anonymous if she hadn't accepted Charlie's invitation to work it out on the remix. It felt like, or at least practically functioned as, the moment when Charlie decided to let Bratt speak for itself. Exactly. Charlie's frequent collaborator Aidan Zamiri confirms of her choice to not explicate songs that dropped enough hints to be fairly explicit to fans paying close attention, though remained inscrutable but Googleable to the casual viewer who's only aware she's a little bit bitchy. Charlie is very instinctive about how she wants to share information, and I liked that one of the things she said about the album is that she tried to not lean into metaphors, Zamiri says. With the exception of the omnipresent Julia Fox, I'm So Julia, 360, and Lord, Charlie has mostly left it up to the internet to imagine the truth about the subjects of her music. A New York Magazine writer tried to get Charlie to discuss whether Sympathy is a Knife is about Taylor Swift, as was a common interpretation of lyrics that mentioned dreading seeing someone backstage at her boyfriend's show. In 2023, Swift dated Daniel's 1975 bandmate Matty Healy, who would subsequently crowd surf at Charlie and Daniel's Italian Wedding Redux. The song features a momentary fit of resentment in the chorus. "'Cause I couldn't even be her if I tried. I'm opposite. I'm on the other side. I feel all these feelings I can't control. Oh no, don't know why. All this sympathy is just a knife." "You do the silence game," Charlie told the magazine, refusing to acquiesce to a discussion about whether she'd thought of leaving out a particularly revealing line. "But I know that well, where you go silent and want me to talk more. But I don't care about it being awkward. We'll sit in silence." "I think I'm just quite direct and blunt," Charlie tells me, when I ask about that moment and talk about how different it feels from how warm she's been today. "I hate this phrase, but what you see is what you get with me. People think it's all some kind of performance, but it's not. I'm not sitting here talking to you being the way that I am on stage. But I think there is a correlation in that there's a messiness and a lack of perfection. It's the combination of talking about those things whilst also embracing them and really struggling with them is what makes me whole. And I think that it makes me honest. You can vouch for me, I hope." I tell her I can't fact-check her heart, but my impression is that Charlie is incredibly sincere. "Or I'm a psychopath," she says, cackling. Last September, in the middle of the Sweat tour, and right before the Brat 2024 arena tour, Charlie sent Zamiri a message, or as he describes it, word vomit. Zamiri had worked with Charlie directing the Guess and 360 videos, the latter featuring an It Girl theme embodied by guest stars, including Fox. YouTube star Emma Chamberlain, model and Healy's fiancé Gabriette, actors Ari Neff and Rachel Sennett, and proto-It Girl Chloe Sevigny. "It almost felt like a diary entry of, 'This is how I feel right now,'" Zamiri says of Charlie's message. "This feeling of having just almost got everything she could have wanted and what that felt like on kind of a human level." The document became the genesis for the moment. Zamiri and Bertie Brandes finished the screenplay in a few months with input from Charlie, and Zamiri filmed it last spring. "I really don't think I've ever met anyone who works as hard as Charlie does," Sivan says, noting that in between Sweat dates, Charlie would take on roles in movies, including Greg Araki's I Want Your Sex, in which Araki says Charlie does a top-notch American accent and nailed a scene in which she's faking an orgasm with Cooper Hoffman's character. "What was Sivan doing during his downtime? Resting," he says. One project Charlie turned down during this period was a tour documentary. She felt the market was already saturated with similar projects and says, "I feel like my problem with a lot of musician documentaries is it often shows the musician coming up against some kind of opposition and eventually overcoming it to be the hero. And that's just not been my experience, you know. Maybe it has been a lot of other people's, and that's awesome." Charlie calls the moment a 2024 period piece. It's not a tour documentary or a concert film in any way, but the seed of the idea was conceived from this idea of being pressured to make one, she says. "It's fiction, but it's the realest depiction of the music industry that I've ever seen." Asked to describe his role, Skarsgård says he plays someone whom the record label convinces Charlie is the hottest director out there at the moment. the right person to capture the essence of Charlie XCX and get the most out of this phenomenon that Brat was. Director Zamiri calls Skarsgård's character one of the villains or antagonists of the film. Charlie herself may be another one. She describes her role as sort of a hell version of myself. Zamiri is cagier about the plot, saying only that the film explores what would have happened if Charlie had made entirely different choices around Brat. As far as we know, in this counterfactual, Charlie's viral ex-post, Kamala is Brat, still does not make Harris win the presidential election against Donald Trump. At least, as Charlie told Zane Lowe, she's obviously happy to be on the right side of history. The moment features a score by Cook and judicious deployment of Charlie performing tracks from Brat. Skarsgård did not reveal to Charlie until after they'd wrapped that she was his second most played artist on Spotify in 2024. The first was a Japanese pop star from the 1970s and 80s named Aichi Otake, which Skarsgård concedes is a very Brat choice. He has just seen Charlie perform for the first time at a music festival in Gothenburg, Sweden, a few days before we speak, and says, "I got to see the snippets of that when we shot the movie. But the other night, when I got to see the full show, it was really remarkable how the second she steps off stage, she sheds that part of her personality. Then she's back to being the sweet little Charlie." Charlie views making the moment as an almost therapeutic exercise. "I always find it hard to sit down and look at things with distance because I'm always moving on to the next thing," she says. "I think that I process myself through my work. I'm writing about myself and my thoughts all the time, and my thoughts about what people think about me." Charlie gestures toward infinity with a Queen Elizabeth wave. The meta-ness continues. The obvious follow-up to Brat would have been to make more music, as Charlie had done after her previous 5 studio albums. Especially now that there was the option that, as she says, you could just do more of that thing, because now that's what people see you as. You've solidified this brand that people seem to understand and want to digest very easily. That was not particularly inspiring to Charlie. And also, as she'd word vomited to Zamiri, she'd basically gotten everything she wanted. "Did I need everyone's validation to feel that way?" Charlie asked of her secondhand self-acceptance. "I guess I probably did, and that's probably why I am an artist. But I think once I had that experience, that's reward enough for me to feel satisfied in that area for a while." 20 minutes later, her zen has evaporated somewhat. "I don't think one day I'm going to wake up and be like, I feel confident, and I'm done with feeling anything else other than confidence," Charlie says. "Some days I feel totally destroyed and completely in the depths of misery. But I also need the high contrast to be able to create anything. If I was happy all the time, I probably wouldn't be making art." While Charlie says she doesn't know if or when she'll release another album, she's already been working on more music, albeit for a fictional character. She and Jack Antonoff wrote songs for Mother Mary, the David Lowery film in which Anne Hathaway plays a famous musician. "We were making music that I don't think I would ever make for my artist project. Songs for Charlie XCX, but still, music that I truly love." In addition to contributing music for Hathaway's character, Charlie told her, at her request, what being a pop star is like. "She was so generous sharing her experiences," Hathaway says. "It was like chatting with a girlfriend." "She was the opposite of aloof," Hathaway says. "I was delighted at how friendly and real she was. Her talent is one that's easily underappreciated because the end result feels so fun and achievable, but it's actually a stunningly rare feat." As Charlie revises history in the moment, a major difference between the film and real life is that there is no George Daniel character. overcompensating creator and star Benito Skinner met Charlie at a party at Cara Delevingne's house. He and his boyfriend Terry O'Connor, who subsequently collaborated with Charlie on the look and rollout of Brat and the Kamala Harris post, became close with her and Daniel. If you don't believe in love or straight relationships, which I usually don't, I believe in this one, Skinner says. Before a 1975 show at Hollywood Bowl, Charlie got glam to be in the audience because she told Skinner, "I'm a hot girlfriend tonight." At Coachella, Skinner stood with Daniel while Charlie performed. "I just watched him watch her," Skinner says. "It was so sweet. He just had his Aperol spritz, and that's his queen." Charlie and Daniel got married in London's Hackney District in late July. The planning wasn't painstaking. They just happened to have time in their schedules and made it work. Charlie didn't get her a Vivienne Westwood dress until 5 days before the ceremony. "It's cool to be married," Charlie says, in a tone that would also be appropriate for talking about an interestingly shaped rock. "I never really saw it for myself, to be honest." Her own parents didn't wed until she was 16. "I think one day they were like feeling it," she says, "and I think that's so sweet." "It was cool to feel so in love and do it our way," Charlie says, now ceding a bit of gushiness to her husband. "We both kind of just wanted to not feel the pressures of the things you're supposed to feel when you get married." Charlie did not want to feel, she says, like this is the day of your life as a woman. "I'm like, it's actually just another cool day." They woke up, had breakfast at All Press in Dalston, and then we just went and did it, Charlie says. "It was cute. He's the best." While she does not mention his less flattering angles, and based on everyone I talked with, he doesn't seem to have many, Charlie says he really understands who I am at my best and at my worst. "When he's deep within making a 1975 record and needs perspective, we can talk about it, and vice versa," Charlie says. "It feels very calming to have that. Sometimes you have to really grapple with fear and expectation and it being over." When I talked to Charlie a few weeks later, right after the Brat tour is over, she has already moved on to the next thing, which she acknowledges is probably some kind of a protection defense mechanism from having to sit and feel the empty space of the silence between creative projects. Charlie launches into describing her next enterprise, writing songs for Emerald Fennell's adaptation of Wuthering Heights, starring Margot Robbie and Jacob Elordi. "That's the world I've been living in," Charlie says. Despite the internet's apparent horror at the idea that the film might feature pop music anachronistic to the largely 18th century setting, someone posted that it was like the Matcha Dubai Chocolate Labubu of film. She tells me it's an elegant and brutal sound palette. It couldn't be more different from Brat. The end of that sentence could apply to Charlie's entire shift to film, which has bled even into her social media. In addition to her many acting roles, Charlie has cultivated an amusing cinephilic presence on the movie review site Letterboxd under the handle It's Charlie BB, where she chronicles her personal consumption and occasionally the status of her projects. Sample review of Joel Coen's The Tragedy of Macbeth. Watch this whilst George built Lego. 5 stars. I saw the film Phantom Thread, Charlie says, of the Paul Thomas Anderson film about the self-inflicted tortures of being an artistic genius. The main character, played by Daniel Day-Lewis, only steps away from his work when he's sick, so his wife deliberately gives him toxic mushrooms so he can take breaks and they have time to connect. It's actually a really nice relationship. I was like, oh my God, that's so me, Charlie says. When I get sick, George nurses me back to health, and that's when I feel calm. She adds, but he doesn't poison me. There's no way for me to fact check. Charlie says she can only rest when her body shuts down and tells her, "No, Charlie, you must stop. Life's so short," she says. "There's so much I want to do. I want to just constantly be doing it." Articles about New York mayoral candidate Zamdani, Richard Prince's artworks, and other topics coming up in the next installments of Vanity Fair. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast at our website, www.ncreadingservice.org. For questions or comments about our programming, please call us at 919-832-5138. Opening and closing music for this podcast by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.